The topic tonight is grace through redemption. And redemption is a theme that doesn't just come into place in the New Testament. It runs through the whole Bible. And so if you ever go through a big city, or perhaps you go through a poorer section, you're going to see a number of pawn shops standing around there. And what happens is people that don't have much in the way of money or resources, they'll take something in and they'll pawn it. Essentially, they borrow money on it and they get a ticket, which they have to keep. And within so many days, if they come back and pay the money, plus interest, they get their item back. It's redeemed. But in the meantime, it sits on the shelf in the pawn shop. And if they don't come back, or if they lose the ticket, then it becomes the property of the pawn shop, and the pawn shop owner turns around and sells it. And so that is a modern day example of redemption. And so in Hosea 11:1 and in Matthew again in 12:2-15, we find out of Egypt I have called my son. But in the Hosea account, we see that the more the prophets called, the less the people listened. And they would not do what they were supposed to do. So Hosea 11:1, when Israel was a youth, I loved him. And out of Egypt I called my son. The more they called them, the more they went from them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. And so they called, you know, like a disobedient dog. You call, they turn and look at you, and then they go the other way. I don't suppose you've ever had a dog like that, but anyway. But in Matthew 2:15, we find quite a different account. Because there it says, Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. He remained there until the death of Herod, which was to fulfill what's been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Now, in the Matthew account, the calling, and some commentators have cavilled a little that the prophet Hosea was talking about a past event. Out of Egypt I called my son. He didn't talk about it happening again, but there's a sense there in the original language that in the word fulfilled can also mean perfected. Okay? And so, in the Matthew account, the calling was made perfect. Because in Hosea account, what does it say? The more I called, the more they went from me. But the calling was made perfect in the Matthew account because Jesus was always obedient to God, obedient even unto death. So unlike the nation, Jesus did the will of the Father and was obedient. And so we see a history of redemption. We're going to talk more about this, but a teaching of redemption. And we're going to start with Egypt. Out of Egypt I call my son. But it culminates in redemption what? Made perfect. Made perfect. Because anybody that is saved is redeemed, bought out of the slave market of sin, and set on the path to heaven. And so the nation then was redeemed out of slavery in Egypt. I'm going to go back to Exodus now. You should have some of these verses in your sheet. Exodus 3, 7 and 8. God is talking to Moses and he's telling him what he's going to do. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their suffering. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, Hivite, and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Egypt has come up to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. And so, he's going to deliver them. In Exodus 6:6, it's again redemption. Because God says, "Say therefore to the sons of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage, and I will also redeem you with an outstretched arm and great judgment." So he's going to redeem them, but not with money. Okay? He says, "I'm going to redeem you out, but I'm going to do it with an outstretched arm and great judgment. They don't want to let you go. I'm going to pound them till they do," essentially, if I could paraphrase. So, this is macro, if you will, redemption. The whole nation was redeemed. All of them. But the plagues freed the nation. The Passover lamb freed the firstborn, shaved them from death. And it was through two things. Number one, the death of the lamb that they had to sacrifice. And number two, the obedience of the people to believe and depend on the death of the lamb. The death of the lamb by itself avails nothing without the obedience. First to believe, then to put the blood on the lintels, and then to celebrate the Passover. All these things are part and parcel of the same thing. When we do our communion, in essence, that is our Passover of the church, because we are remembering what? Being redeemed. Just like Israel remembered being redeemed through the Passover, on that Passover night, when Jesus said, "I have desired with great desire to eat this last Passover with you before I suffer." And then he says, "Take, eat, this is my body which is given for you. Drink ye all of it. This is my blood that is shed for the new covenant." So now we have a new Passover that we celebrate. Now, when the people rebelled, invariably they spoke about Egypt. So if we look at Exodus 16:3, the people complained about no food. "We're hungry." They remembered the food in Egypt. They said, "We sat by the pots of meat and we ate bread to the full." You know, they also were beaten if they didn't deliver the number of bricks, but apparently that has slipped into their forgetfulness. In Numbers 14:4, the people were afraid to enter the promised land. They were camped by the Jordan. They didn't have the courage. They didn't have the faith to go across. And so, they said, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." Now, slavery was what they had known. Slavery was what they had been born into. In fact, slavery was what they knew all their lives. And there's a lot of people today who are essentially free people looking for someone to tell them what to do. They'll join themselves to this group or that group or, you know, some other goofy group. I get people sending me stuff, you know, on Facebook by some self-proclaimed expert. "Well, you know, this is the way to do things," or "this is what you should do." But I generally have about a dozen questions that I ask concerning this person or this new movement, and they have trouble answering. But I'm a skeptical man by nature, I guess. Anyway, slavery, to a degree, is part of the human condition because humans do like to have someone telling them what to do. Do this, do that, then do something else. And if someone else told you what to do it, then you're not responsible if it goes bad, right? I'm just following orders. They did an experiment in college where they had a person doing some tasks, and there was a meter that was supposed to give them an electric shock if they did something wrong. And so it was, by the way, the meter and the shock was all totally bogus. What it was testing was someone's tendency to follow orders. And so they had like numbers from 10 to 100. And so they'd say, okay, if he misses the first one, give him a number 10 shock. So they wouldn't. The guy sitting on the other end might go like this a little bit. But there was a red line on the meter. Maybe it's 70, 80, whatever it was. I don't remember. I read this a long time ago. You know, it says something like, do not exceed. And so then they would say, okay, if he misses number 10, you know, give him a 75. You know, and the guy go, ah, like that. And you know what? The volunteers almost universally, faithfully cranked that up past the red line and pushed the button. Even though it clearly said on the meter, do not exceed. But someone else was telling them what to do. They had their orders. Now, I myself find it extremely improbable. And I find that the test results, the experiment results, hard to believe. But yet, that's what happened. In the course of blindly following orders, they didn't know if they were going to shock somebody to death. But yet they still continued. And so we should not be particularly surprised that the Israelites said, well, let's go back to, you know, to Egypt. Better the evil that we know than the freedom that's unknown to us. So they preferred an unknown evil to an unknown blessing. We have to be careful of that in our daily lives. Because God might send us out to do this, that, or something else. We don't know. We don't know. I did not go to divinity school and learn how to preach. Okay? I was in the STEM sort of program, chemistry, physics, mathematics, those sorts of things. And I entered the pulpit just about as reluctantly as Moses went to Egypt, you know. I used some of the same arguments, but I was pressed into service because of a pressing need. And so you don't know where God is going to send you. You don't know what God is going to ask you to do. And so the question then becomes, if you're not doing something, or if you're doing nothing, do you prefer that to an unknown blessing? You don't know what God's going to bless you with. You don't know what He has in His hand that He wants to give you, that you're too foolish or stubborn to reach out and take. He said to Israel, why don't you try me and test me? Why don't you give me what you're supposed to give me and see if I don't open up my hand and pour out a blessing so big for you, you won't even have place to put it. But yet, they preferred a known evil where they were to an unknown blessing. When they went into a new nation, and we talked about macro redemption, redeeming the whole nation. When they had land and a home, the micro, the individual, was not forgotten. Because if an Israelite fell on hard times, he could be sold as a slave. Now you take bankruptcy, but in those days you could be, all you and all you had could be sold. And so in Leviticus, I'm going to read that to you, Leviticus 25. It talks about a poor countryman. So, in 47, I'm going to go back to 47. Now, if the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you become sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendant of a stranger's family. Now, the designation of stranger is important, because if it's an Israelite, provision is made elsewhere. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this is a non-Israelite. Then he shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. And so, a kinsman then, and it was considered a duty to come and redeem that slave. Now, if the individual was sold to someone from Israel, then it's a different thing. In Exodus 21, we read that if you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years. But on the seventh, he shall go out as a free man without payment. Just think about the slavery issue in this country and the problems remaining to this day. And if the men of that time had been wise enough to say, if you buy a slave, he'll serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year, he'll go out free. Think of the difference it would have made both then and now. But God's law is wiser and more compassionate than our law, even to this day. Even to this day. And so the slave would know that he was going to go out free. But in the Jubilee year, which is also in Leviticus 25, the slave was also to be freed. And we're going to look at that now. Leviticus 25, 28. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, and he's talking about a field there, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of the Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert, that he may return to his property. Also verse 54, and this is talking now about the individual, not the field. Even if he is not redeemed by these means, he shall still go out in the year of the Jubilee, he and his sons with him. So any children the man had during the time he was enslaved also go with him in the year of the Jubilee. Now, in 25:25, it says that if a countryman becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, his nearest kinsman is to come, and buy back what his relative has sold. Just think what a year 1980 would have been in this country if we would have had a Jubilee year. In 1930, my grandfather lost his farm. And they moved and they lived as like tenant farmers on a place that a lady in town lived. And he was not the only one. Thousands and thousands of people lost farms and homes in 1930. And the banks failed. There was a bank holiday. But think of 1980, if in 50 years at the Jubilee, all that would have had to be restored. In 2009, when things got bad in this country, houses went underwater like crazy. And many, many, many people lost their homes. Think of what a year 2059 would be if there was a jubilee and the bank had to give those all back. Some people say that God's law in the Old Testament was too strict and too harsh. But I say that it was far-reaching and compassionate in many ways, more so than what we do today in this country, which is supposed to be a beacon of freedom and light. Now, should a man die and there was nobody to inherit the land, then a kinsman could raise a child to inherit it. And the book of Ruth is all about this. Okay? You all remember the book of Ruth, and the kinsman was Boaz. And Ruth was a Moabite woman. And so he did marry Ruth, and her child then could inherit the land that came to the family through the father who had since died, and the sons who had since died. And so the kinsman had to be willing, able, and of course related. That's in Deuteronomy 25:5. I'm going to read that just briefly. All these pictures of redemption, though, are not in here by accident. It says, when brothers live together, one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her, and it shall be the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So, we see there that we have a kinsman who can raise up a child and take the place so that name won't be lost in Israel. If he's willing, if he's able, and if he's related. Now, in Deuteronomy 32:6, God is, and also in Exodus 4:22, God is named as the Father of the nation. Deuteronomy 32:6 says, "Do you thus repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is not he your father who has bought you? He has made you and established you." So he's the father of the nation. Exodus 4:22 and 23 is also the same thought, although in a little more detail. "You shall say to Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn." So God then is a kinsman redeemer to all the nation. And these various laws show that both nationally and personally, he is willing and able to redeem. As father of the nation, he's related. He told the nation, "I don't want you selling the land. The land is mine. I own the land. You're stewards of it. And in the Jubilee year, it's going to go back to whoever I gave it to. They're going to keep it." This is a thought that we should cherish for today, because all of us have a certain amount of money or houses or whatever. We're stewards of that money. We get to run it for a period of time, but not permanently. Not permanently. It's got to be given back when we're done with it. Someone else is going to have it. Someone else will be steward for a while. And Paul said, if you are a steward, it's necessary that you be faithful. He considered himself a steward of the gospel. And so he had to faithfully distribute it. So now we went into a new covenant. And the new covenant came about when Jesus Christ was born. Before he was born, if you read Matthew 1:21, it says, "Thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." In the Aramaic, it would have been Yeshua. "Thou shalt call his name Yeshua," which means Yahweh's deliverance or Yahweh's salvation. And the reason for the name is he's going to save his people from their sins. And he said to his disciples, "You know that the Gentiles that achieve position lord it over their servants and boss them around. But," he said, "I did not come to be served. I came to serve and to give my life a ransom for many." And so, for the people of God, a distinction in them is a desire to serve. I've known it to be explained as the servant's heart. I want to do something for somebody. I want to do something. I want to do some good with my life. And it can be any one of a million different things. Different people have different skill and ability, different talents, different resources. But the desire to serve, the desire to give something, the desire to do something should be universal in the Church of Christ. If you don't have any desire to give or to serve or to do something good, then you got some work to do. Like the lamb at Passover, then, it's necessary for people to believe and obey. Because a door is opened to give people access to God. And if we go to John 10:9, passage that I really like, it says, "I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved and go in and out and find pasture." And so we have kind of a picture here of a sheepfold. They used to make them up of rocks in the Holy Land because they foolishly cut too many trees down in years gone by, but there would be a door there. And a sheep could go in there at night and be safe. They're saved. Nothing could get in there and get at them. But yet they could go in and out and find pasture. Their needs would be taken care of. They could eat, they could drink. And so there's a door opened. I am the door. You need to come through me. So if you wish to go through the door, and who wouldn't, you have to do it in God's way. Jesus says, "I am the door." Now, some people stubbornly wish to obtain access to God in their own way. I've heard many things. I had a relative that was very fond of saying, "I'm as good as anyone else." True. It fires it goes. But the Bible also said, "There is none good, no, not one." And so, if you're not good, and nobody is good, then you need to go through that door. And Jesus said also, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me." And so, it's not only once in the Scripture, it's many times in the Scripture. He told those who followed him, in John 8 that if they would continue in his word, and I'm going to read that portion, starting in John 8:31, Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And so they followed him. They saw what he was doing. They believed he was something, some kind of prophet. And so he's saying, all right, you saw, you know, now I'm telling you, you need to continue in my word. And you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free. They answered him, we are Abraham's descendants and have never yet been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? We're good just like we are. We don't need anything more. Like their forefathers in Egypt, their current condition was what they knew. It's what they understood. It's where they had been since they were born. And they said, this is good enough for us. Like the former slaves in Egypt, they preferred an unknown evil to a no blessing. No man who has drank old wine straightway desireth new, for he saith the old is good enough. And that was spoken in terms of his ministry. And the scribes and Pharisees were drinking the old wine, what they were familiar with, what they were accustomed to. And they said, it's good of its kind. If you chase the Greek, it means good of its kind. Some translation might say better. But it's good of its kind. They didn't want any new stuff. They preferred a known evil to an unknown blessing. So they didn't want to step out in obedience. And though they were really not free, they thought they were free, and they said so. And so the Jewish people at the time wanted and expected from the Messiah national redemption and freedom from what? Rome. They're looking at the macro case. They wanted freedom from Rome. They did not expect, nor did they desire, personal redemption that would require change. Because he said to them, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine. It's all right if you're listening to it, but I want you to do it. That's where the shoe pinches sometimes. Sometimes listening is good, doing not so much. So his reply to them is very instructive. And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, anyone who commits sin is the slave of sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. Son stays. So we need to be redeemed personally, each and every one. Like the nation in Egypt, we need to do two things. Number one, believe. Number two, obey. Because belief without obedience falls short. Now, Jesus is able. He is willing. And if we accept him, we'll be related. We'll be in Christ. We'll be a brother to Christ. We'll be a joint heir with Christ. We'll be in the will. This is what we need. Now, setting the captive free is an important part of redemption. Someone was in slavery, they were freed. Now, in case you think there are no slaves today, think again. Because people still prefer a known evil to an unknown blessing. We haven't changed all that much. There's a lot of masters who drive their slaves hard every day. Master greed makes people work 70, 80 hours a week. They make money. They got no time to spend it. They're stressed. They have ulcers. They have high blood pressure. They don't sleep well. They don't eat right. They don't have time for private or family life. Work consumes all they have to give. It eats it all up. And the work becomes an end in itself rather than a means to an end. They are enslaved to mammon. And they work as hard as any slave. You ever go by a place and see people in their coats standing outside shivering? That's master tobacco making them go outside to smoke. If the boss asks them to go outside and stand there for wages, they say, "What are you, crazy? It's cold out there." But they'll do it for master tobacco. Master pride, close friend of master greed, makes people buy things that they don't need and can't afford. Drives them into bankruptcy. I got to have something to, you know, I got to keep up with the Joneses. Everybody has it. Master alcohol sends good people out on his highway and they kill and maim other people. They get picked up by the cops, have their name in the paper. Now, if you ask somebody, a random guy on the street, "Hey, I want you to go out and get arrested this weekend and have to post bail and hire a lawyer and your name will be printed in the paper. If I want you to do that for me," what do you think they tell you? "What are you, crazy?" But they'll do it for master alcohol. I'll tell you what, if you look in the convictions, there's somebody in there most every week. Coveting. Those who covet sometimes steal. They get arrested for shoplifting. Those who covet somebody else's spouse turn their whole world upside down. Nothing will ever be the same for them. Well, we look at the beginning of public ministry of Jesus to see what he intended. He was given the scroll in the synagogue. And he turned to Isaiah, and here's what he read. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, and proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." Then he told his hearers that the prophecy was fulfilled in their hearing. "I'm going to do it. This is what I came for."